Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Rogner is participating today by speakerphone, so if you hear a disembodied voice emerging from the walls, it is not an emanation from the ectoplasm. It is actually our colleague. We are ready to hear the first case this morning, which is Poloyan against LaSalle Bank. Mr. Audley.
May it please the court and Judges Rovner, Easterbrook, and Tinder, good morning. My name is David Audley, and I represent LaSalle as trustee, who is the defendant in the underlying adversary proceeding brought by the Chapter 11 trustee in the bankruptcy court. In these consolidated appeals, Your Honor, LaSalle as trustee is appealing from those judgments entered by Judge Schmetterer on counts 8 and 9 of the adversary complaint that had been filed by the bankruptcy trustee. Those counts centered on section utilization of section 544B, the strong-arm provision of the bankruptcy code, and section 550A, which is the code provision that provides for which entity, if relief is going to be awarded, which entity would be responsible for that relief. Essentially, section 544B incorporates by reference to go back 4 years, which the bankruptcy trustee needed to do in this case. They utilized the Illinois Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, which is a state-based substantive law, which allows for a trustee in bankruptcy to go back 4 years, or a four-year continuum, to determine if there was a fraudulent transfer. So the state law provides the substantive law that the trustee, bankruptcy trustee, relied upon in this case. And the trustee's theory of the case, bankruptcy trustee's theory of the case, was that Doctors Hospital had paid rent to a special purpose entity called HPCH LLC in an amount that was well in excess of the market rent that Doctors Hospital should have been paying. Now, we'll get into the apparatus of how the financings occurred here, but the theory was that this over-market rent constituted a fraudulent transfer on a monthly basis, starting at a specific point and ending at the bankruptcy petition date of April 17th of 2000.
I hope I'm not, jumping the gun, but if I am, forgive me. But, sort of bottom line-ish, the Chapter 11 trustee says that MMA funding was a sham organization with no purpose, no function. No jobs, no assets other than to act as a go-between the hospital and Daiwa, to insulate Daiwa from the hospital's potential bankruptcy, owned 99% by the hospital, 1% by that entity that's owned by the owner of the hospital. What's your response to all of this?
Well, Judge Rovner, that is indeed the position taken by the Chapter 11 trustee on their cross appeal, attacking the decision by Judge Schmetterer, determining that from and after July of 1998 up into the petition date, that the monies that were transferred were indeed not Doctors Hospital's money. And the argument is that from the Chapter 11 trustee's standpoint is indeed, as Judge Rovner, you indicated, it's somehow a sham. Well, the response to that is if that's a sham, then you would have to identify sophisticated commercial parties entering into sophisticated and negotiated documents, realizing exactly what was going on is entirely a sham in and of itself. If by the use of the word sham that someone was being defrauded, that's absolutely not the case whatsoever. Indeed, as Judge Schmetterer found and as the facts and evidence absolutely support, Daiwa went into the deal with its eyes wide open and, as a matter of fact, absolutely requiring that MMA funding be established as a special purpose entity, and indeed that it would have no function other than to receive the receivables from Doctors Hospital pursuant to the contribution agreement, the receivables. It was never contemplated that it would function in the normal sense of a corporation manufacturing widgets, et cetera. That absolutely was the understanding.
Tell me why it why MMA funding dropped out of the picture after July 7th of 98.
Judge Rover, MMA funding did not drop out of the picture. As a matter of fact, the Daiwa securitization or the Daiwa financing continued from and after July of 1998 to the petition date. I think what you may be referring to is that Judge Schmetterer ruled and found, based upon the evidence, that from and after July 7th of 98, it actually worked as all the parties intended for the cash flow to work, utilizing MMA funding as the special purpose entity. It did not drop out. As a matter of fact, it continued. For example, in February of 1999, Daiwan MMA funding even entered into an amendment to extend the $25 million facility for another 2 years. So respectfully, Your Honor, they did not drop out.
And one other question on this, and then I know that you need to go back to your argument, but all of this has really bothered me. You know, I looked at that diagram on page 9 of the appellee's brief, which purports to illustrate the cash flow after July 7th. Would you agree that the illustration is accurate?
If we're looking at what was attached, for example, as Exhibit C, I think, to Judge Pallmeyer's decision reported at 406BR299, indeed, Your Honor, it does indicate how the cash flow was to, I'm sorry, Exhibit D. It does purport to...
This was not a question about Exhibit D. This was a question about the diagram on page 9 of the trustee's brief.
Yes, I believe it accurately reflects the flow of cash from and after July of 1998.
So you wouldn't change it?
Your Honor, if I may just grab the brief so I make sure that there are a number. May I, Your Honor?
Certainly.
Thank you. I apologize, Judge Rovner. Indeed, that does indicate the flows of cash from and after July of 1998. So to answer your question directly, we would not indicate that that needed to be changed in any substantive way. The flow of cash, again, was to go all along the continuum where Daiwa would deposit through the advances to MMA funding the amounts through both a payment direction letter and through an intercreditor agreement with Nomura. And
so you don't think MMA funding is missing from that document?
It is missing only in the sense, Your Honor, that if you wanted to go to the on page 9, if you went further left on the diagram, MMA funding should be there. It's just that they kind of cut it off because MMA funding is still based upon the renewal of the Daiwa facility in February of 99 all the way through the process. They were the ones who were providing the funding through the receivables that it would pledge to Daiwa.
Well, but when you say it's missing from the diagram, that's kind of like, you know, Damon Runyon's dice, where all the numbers are rubbed off, and you're supposed to imagine the numbers.
Well, Your Honor, I can appreciate the court's observation about where was MMA funding in all of this process. But while the schematic does attempt to describe the flow of cash, it doesn't attempt to universally explain how all of the entities in the loan documents were to interplay, as Judge Schmetterer found. And while you can use this as a demonstrative aid, it does not take into account, I readily respect, Judge Rovner, your comment, it does not readily take into account MMA funding's continued role in this process.
Okay, well, I appreciate, you know,
right.
I think
since
I took you off your game. So
since we are on the cross-appeal, let me ask a distinct question about the cross-appeal. The MMA is going to operate as a bankruptcy remote vehicle only if it has purchased the hospital's receivables and purchased them in a transaction that did not itself render the hospital insolvent. I wonder how MMA, in what sense MMA purchased the receivables. What did it give the hospital in exchange for the receivables?
What it gave were two things, I believe, Your Honor. First of all, it gave almost a universal interest in and to its equity, number one, so it could possibly...
It didn't have any equity.
Well,
it was a shell corporation.
Or any potential down-the-road dividends, but further than that...
Look, suppose I go up to a hospital and say, give me all your receivables, and there may be a potential for down-the-road dividends, but I'm not promising you squat. Is that a reasonably equivalent trade?
Well, Your Honor, depending on how the parties look at where the financing is going to go, absolutely it could be at the time that you enter into the transaction. Indeed, a lot of
that
companies...
That does not sound like an ordinary commercial transaction in which a going business gives up essentially all of its income in exchange for, nothing.
Well,
it puzzles me. Maybe the trustee has forfeited any argument based on this by not making it in its brief. But I don't see how you can have a genuine bankruptcy remote vehicle without actually buying the receivables as opposed to taking an assignment of them, which seems to be what happened here.
Well,
and
Your Honor,
I don't understand how assigning the receivables, this happened in March 1997, I believe,
yes, Your Honor,
without any exchange, could do anything other than render the hospital insolvent as of March 1997.
Well, Your Honor, two things to respond to that. First, in addition to the contribution of the receivables in a true sale, where a true sale opinion was given by the law firms, in addition to that, over a million...
that says... Any assignment of receivables is a true sale has committed malpractice. It doesn't support the transaction. This opinion looked to me like the kind of opinion that's rendered in tax shelter cases and is probably a ground for prosecuting the lawyer rather than for insulating the transaction.
Your Honor, the structure is typically structured so that an opinion is given in the form that it was provided in this case. Over and above, however, the absolute contribution of the receivables, Doctors Hospital did receive over $1.3 million in cash right away. What the immediate $10 million was utilized for, Your Honor, was not only to retire an existing facility that Doctors Hospital had, but in addition, it received cash for its own benefit, $1.3 million right away for its own uses. Judge Schmetter identified that. We provided that in the briefs that we filed, Your Honor. So in addition to the...
Is there an argument that $1.3 million was reasonably equivalent value for the present value of the stream of receivables?
Well, Your Honor, it was not and it should not have been the LaSalle as trustee's burden to prove that at trial. It should have been the Chapter 11 trustee's burden to prove that it was not.
Well, as I say, it may be right that this possibility that the critical fraudulent conveyance is the thing that occurred in March 1997. Maybe this argument has been forfeited. But trying to figure out whether MMA is a real bankruptcy remote vehicle does seem to me to require thinking about this.
But Your Honor, I understand Your Honor's point. All we can say is that indeed the bankruptcy trustee did not present this as such a case at trial, did not present it on appeal, and so to suggest that the LaSalle as trustee needed to try to address those concerns in the type of detail that Your Honor is questioning. I understand the questions. All I can tell you is that the true sale opinion was given, the contribution agreement was executed, and Doctors Hospital ended up at least with $1.3 million in cash.
Okay. Now let me ask you one question not related to the cross appeal, but related to the direct appeal. The parties seem to be unable to agree on the question whether the finding of insolvency in late 1997 depended on what the parties refer to as the tax effect, although they can't agree on whether it's a tax effect or a tax effect. But whether this 40% reduction for hypothetical taxes of a hypothetical buyer, parties don't seem to be able to agree on whether that was essential to the finding of insolvency in late 1997. Now, your position, as I understand it, is that it is. It is essential. So if you knock that out, you knock out the finding of insolvency. Could you address why you think that's essential to the bankruptcy judge's finding?
Judge, by the use of the word essential, I will try and be as specific as I can. Without the tax affecting, in combination with at least one or others, if you just isolate tax affecting, and as Mr. Blake, the expert witness, indicated below, you would get to a positive net enterprise value at the end of the day. But
that's your bottom line. I'm asking why you believe that. Because the trustee doesn't believe that. So I'm trying to figure out why you believe what you believe, not just what do you believe.
Because we believe if you take the chart out, Your Honor, that was part of the exhibits attached to the bankruptcy trustees.
So where do I find this?
It's Exhibit C2.
So where do I find this?
Yes. Exhibit 159.
Where do I find this?
Your
right.
Honor,
in
it
an
is...
an appendix someplace. It will have a page reference.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, Your Honor, if I may get the appendix. Your Honor, it's tab 8 to the appendix. My apologies.
Don't have tabs. Could you give me a page reference?
Your Honor, my appendix does not have a page reference to it.
Filed an appendix without pagination. Great.
It is the absolute last page of the appendix.
Well, I've got the last page if I tilt my computer sideways. Okay. Now we're at the same place.
And, Your Honor, if you look at what is called 1997 Amex column, it's the first column starting from left to right, you see down where it says income tax 2.166. If you take, that's the 40% income tax affecting or affecting. If you take that out and you get down to a bottom line, as we've calculated it, you would have a positive value. It will be close, but you will have a positive value. But, Your Honor, we're suggesting that what is appropriate here, Your Honor, is a remand, not necessarily a reversal, because there are, in addition to tax affecting that 40%, which eliminates $2.1 million out of normalized income, and it's important, if I may, Your Honor, keep on that exhibit, it's important to note that you will see multiplied by capitalization multiple, which is down toward the middle of that left-hand column, 6.9%. The methodology utilized by both experts was to normalize income and then capitalize it. So there's a multiplier, and obviously if you subtract monies from above the multiplier, it's going to have not just a dollar-for-dollar impact on the bottom-line valuation, it's going to have a multiple impact by almost 7. So you can take, for example, the 2.166 and have a multiplier of 7 to get up to over $14 million. And Your Honor may note that while it says negative $15,882,000 at the bottom of that left-hand column, that's really their bottom-line number, it's really $14.1 million because the Chapter 11 trustee agrees that we were talking about August 28th of 1997. There had been an approximate $1.6, $1.7 million loss that was reported, so they had to add that back in. So you get down to actually a negative $14.1 million. So you can see where the tax affecting by the multiplier is very important.
Okay, I think I see your argument.
Your Honor,
Mr. Fry should be aware I'll be asking the same question to him.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, getting back then to the solvency issue and picking up on exactly what Your Honor was talking about, at least in that same area, our arguments on appeal as to the solvency are that they picked this date, August 28th of 1997. The bankruptcy court picked that date. And as of that date, in addition to the tax affecting, which we find inappropriate, what they also did in order to get to that negative $15 million number are at least three things. Well, three things, Your Honor. First, they subtracted, again, on that chart, if Your Honor was looking at the chart, I apologize for going back to the chart, but you will see that there is adjustments to net income.
Are you talking about the chart on page 9, or are you talking about the chart on which is Exhibit C?
Judge Rovner, my apologies. I'm talking about the chart on the last chart to the appellant's appendix.
The last page of the last part of the appendix.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. If you look at where it says adjustments to net income, $8,096,000, inclusive in that $8,096,000 was a reduction, again, of $2.6 million from income that the Chapter 11 trustee ascribed to what it called kickback liability or some fraudulent activity. And our point, Your Honor, is under the case law in the Seventh Circuit, and as the Judge Black said in the Edgewater case, which is very close to, if not identical to, the facts that we have here, they took into account and subtracted out that income because in 1999, the first evidence in the record, 1999, 2 years later, there's a letter from an assistant U.S. attorney to Dan Webb, representing Doctors Hospital at the time, saying, we believe there's some kickback activity going on, and here's how we're quantifying it by doctor. And what the Chapter 11 trustee's expert did was, it said, okay, well, that happened 2 years later. I'm going to presume that it was going on August 28th of 97, and I'm going to say this hypothetical willing buyer would have known that and should subtract out the prorated part of that kickback liability.
I can see where you're going, but I actually have a different question about the kickback liability and the upcoding. And again, this is one I want to ask Mr. Fry as well. If it's necessary to put a liability on the hospital's books, essentially in the form of a reserve for this liability, why doesn't one also put on the hospital's books as an asset the amount that Desnick can be required to contribute toward payment? You can't have liabilities without their corresponding assets, and it turns out Desnick's personal liability, and he ended up covering this, was valuable to the hospital. So why does one put the liability in but not the asset?
Your Honor, you're making a very good argument for the defendant.
I'm not making an argument. I'm asking a question. The bankruptcy judge, as I understand it, decided not to put the asset in, and I'm trying to figure out why.
And, Your Honor, we have made that point, and we don't know why either. You need to match it up.
So you think the bankruptcy judge's decision is unexplained as opposed to being
the result of
an incorrect explanation?
Yes, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, the findings of fact in the opinion, the reported opinion, starts talking about the add-backs for the kickback liability and the upcoding. Then it kind of goes silent on why it is you can't count it as an asset. Now, it certainly was argued in the bankruptcy court, well, Dr. Desnick had no contractual responsibility to fund those settlements in 1999 and 2000, and therefore, based solely on that proposition, that you shouldn't count it as an add-back. But the problem we have, Your Honor, is, and as our expert witness dealt with it, well, hold on. How can you, if you're going to create a reserve back in 1997 for events that don't take place and aren't even known until 1999 and 2000, at a minimum, you also have to take into account that Dr. Desnick would be able to and would probably fund these settlements, which indeed he did. So the expert for the defendant rolled forward those two, just as Your Honor indicated. But that was rejected by the court, or at least in its opinion, the court gave no weight or bearing or observation to the fact that Dr. Desnick did fund.
Let me restate what I'm understanding. You think the bankruptcy judge did not put Desnick's assets or his willingness to chip in as an asset because there was no contractual liability. Did anybody consider his common law liability of contribution to the hospital as the tortfeasor?
No, it was not considered, to my knowledge, by
that's one would think a source of assets. Anyway, Mr. Fry is a logical recipient of that question. I'll be asking him that.
Yes, Your Honor. I see that I had reserved some time for rebuttal. I'd be happy to move forward on some, if you have some immediate questions to deal with. But otherwise, I'll reserve.
Okay. Thank you very much. You probably have 30 seconds left, but I'll give you a few extra minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As long as we're asking questions, you'll be able to answer them.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Audley. Mr. Fry.
Good morning.
Well, I've telegraphed some questions for you.
Yeah. I will answer the last one that you raised first, and that is your question whether it's necessary to put in an amount for Dr. Desnick's contributions if we're putting an amount for the fraud liability. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is that the fraud liabilities, there was evidence of those existing, and there was a basis for discounting them. With the Desnick payments, it was totally speculative as to whether Dr. Desnick would ever make any payments. He had no obligation to do so.
That's the question. If Desnick's payment of it was merely out of the goodness of his heart, then you don't book an asset for the hospital to correspond to the goodness of Desnick's heart, which this will be the only evidence of the goodness of Desnick's heart ever encountered. But if, on the other hand, the hospital had a legal right of action, whether in the nature of contribution or indemnity against Desnick, then it's not out of the goodness of his heart. So did the hospital have a legal claim against Desnick?
No, sir. And that's what.
And why not? If Desnick tells people to engage in upcoding, and they do at his direction, you think the hospital doesn't have any claim against him? That would be quite shocking to me.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. That was not raised.
No, I'm not sure. It's perfectly obvious the hospital would have a claim against him.
Well,
now, maybe it wasn't adequately litigated, whether that's the correct way to understand the transaction, but if it is, we're back to my question, how the bank's liability for things done at Desnick's direction could be booked as a liability without booking as an asset the value of the bank's claim against Desnick.
If I could go back for a second, Your Honor, we did have claims. The hospital did have claims against Desnick for breach of fiduciary duty and various other wrongdoing, and we settled those claims. So I think the answer is those claims were made and they were settled.
But what value was attributed during this process to the value of the bank's claims against Desnick? It looks to be zero, right? The bank actually raises claims against Desnick, which it settles for a positive price. Desnick kicks in many millions of dollars for this upcoding and fraud liability without even needing the settlement. I mean, maybe the book should contain $20 million value of claims against Desnick.
But we didn't know. If you're looking at the transaction from August of 1997, no one knows whether Dr. Desnick is going to pay those obligations, and we'd be doing exactly
Look. You obviously have to discount the value of the bank's claims against Desnick in the same way that you have to discount the upcoding liability. But again, my interest is not in the exact amount of the discounting or the percentage of the discounting, but the asymmetric treatment that the liabilities are included, even though they need to be discounted, but the assets are not included. And it doesn't seem to me that you can include one without the other. These liabilities created a corresponding asset in the value of a claim against Desnick. And although it had to be discounted, it had to be included as well.
Well, it was not included, Your Honor. We had claims against Dr. Desnick, and we settled those claims.
I hope again that I'm not taking you, off the path, but is it possible that some people's reference to the hospital as the borrower on the Daiwa loan are simply sort of instances of shorthand? In other words, might people who actually know better still refer to the Daiwa loan as being a loan to the hospital simply because it's a lazy, it's sort of a lazy, although conceitedly incorrect way of simplifying the story, rather than saying, look, Daiwa loaned $25 million to MMA Funding, which was owned 99% by Doctors Hospital, and 1% by MMA Funding, which was owned 100% by Dr. Desnick. I mean, It's no wonder people simplified their statements to say that the hospital was the borrower, even if that's not technically correct, right?
I don't think so, Judge. I think people's statements of their view of who the borrower was based on activity that they were observing. And the way the records were kept by the hospital, the fact that MMA funding had no records whatsoever, the fact that Doctors Hospital did all of the servicing of the loan. I mean, MMA funding had an operating agreement, and it set forth what its operations were supposed to be. And MMA funding never undertook any operations. So when people were making reference to Doctors Hospital being the borrower, I think it reflected what they were seeing in reality. If I could.
I don't know. I think I'm confused. Because I did not understand your statement that MMA funding never accepted any contribution. It was my understanding that prior to July 7th of 98, the funding from Daiwa went through MMA funding on its way to the hospital's payroll and operating fund. And I thought that, you know, your exhibits B and C in your red brief at those tabs 2 and 3 showed that. Well, help me to understand what I'm missing here. I'm missing something.
In the pre-July 1998 period, Your Honor, all MMA funding did was act as a conduit for funds coming from Daiwa to Doctors Hospital. There was an MMA funding bank account, and funds, new borrowings from Daiwa, would go through that account and then automatically be transferred to Doctors Hospital so it could operate its business. So in that period, there was at least an MMA funding bank account that was sitting there and having money flowing through it.
And, of course, MMA funding was owned 100% by Dr. Desnick.
That's right.
So, well, oh, dear.
And then, Judge, what happened, with reference to something you said earlier, what happened after July of 1998,
uh-huh.
And you mentioned that in the diagram, MMA funding did not appear, and that's right.
Right.
They didn't appear because they had basically left the room. They directed that the Daiwa borrowings would come out and go to the LaSalle's cash collateral account. And then they had stepped away. They did that at the first part of the transaction, and from that point afterwards, that money went to the cash collateral account. And the issue is, who owns that money? Is it MMA funding because they're the borrower on the Daiwa loan, or is it Doctors Hospital because MMA funding upstreamed dividends to Doctors Hospital at that point so that Doctors Hospital could pay its obligations to LaSalle by transferring those funds to LaSalle's cash collateral account. MMA funding had no obligations to LaSalle. There was no reason for any of MMA funding's money to go into that cash collateral account. There was a reason for Doctors Hospital's money to go in there, because it was Doctors Hospital's rent payments, as provided in the transaction documents, which LaSalle then took to pay down the Nomura loan, the $50 million Nomura loan.
Under what theory, speaking of LaSalle, under what theory did LaSalle's expert, Mr. Blake, include $18 million in valuing the hospital? Wasn't that sort of the kind of hindsight evidence that you argue the bankruptcy judge engaged in?
Your Honor, I'm not clear what the $18 million is you're referring to.
Well, the expert included $18 million when he valued the hospital. And I just didn't understand what that theory was.
If you're talking, let me get this.
If no one else thinks that's important, you can, you know, just pass on.
Well, there was an addition. LaSalle's expert did add the amount of some assumed contributions by Dr. Desmond. That may be the number that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the bankruptcy court rejected that for just the reason you suggest, and that is that it was using hindsight. Nobody could have known whether Dr. Desnick was going to make those contributions.
You know, your opponent lists cases to say it's inappropriate to deduct an amount equal to that hypothetical 40% tax rate to determine the value of a subchapter S corporation.
Right.
Why wasn't the bankruptcy court wrong to allow this, for tax effecting?
Well, what happened was we put on an insolvency expert, and on this issue, our insolvency expert said that the standard methodology is to tax effect a company, that is to treat it as a C corporation as opposed to a subchapter S corporation. And he had some authority backing him up. He had a textbook by two leading experts in the field that said that's what you do. And he also gave...
That's what you do when doing what?
When
deciding whether a company is solvent or when deciding on the value of the equity securities of the company?
The latter.
The latter. Has any court ever held that it's proper to use it for the former reason? For the former task? Let me tell you why I don't think it's conceivable in principle to use it for the solvency task. Taxes are due only on profits. If the firm has profits, it's solvent. Right? You can't use a tax reduction reflecting the value of profits to answer the basic solvency question. What securities are worth is a function of the current asset value plus the discounted cash flow, the recoverable cash flow. For that, you may need to deduct taxes, but to determine the current value of the company in stasis, I don't see how you can do this.
Your Honor, I don't think the company would need to have profits. I think it would have to have revenues. And this company had revenues, and that's what gets adjusted.
Taxes aren't paid on revenue. Taxes are paid on profits.
Right. In any event, our tax expert gave a number of reasons why he thought that...
You've already conceded that, as far as you know, no court in American history has ever used this to determine solvency. So that leads to my question, which I said I would repeat to you. Does this make a difference? If you eliminate this tax adjustment, is Doctors Hospital solvent or insolvent at the end of 97?
Judge, I'm afraid I have to say I'm not sure. On this appeal, we did not argue specifically that liability or that segment would be outcome determinative. I do recall addressing that issue elsewhere, and we determined
that it
would not.
I read your brief to say that it was not, that you were disagreeing with LaSalle Bank's contention. But if you're not disagreeing with it,
Your Honor,
this case may be now very straightforward.
I think I understand what you're looking at. LaSalle made the argument that the kickback liability alone was outcome determinative. And we pointed out that in their analysis of the kickback liability, they did not tax effect. And we said that if you tax effect, then the kickback liability is not outcome determinative.
Tax effect is not a verb. I don't see how one can use it as a verb.
I'm afraid that's what the literature uses, Your Honor.
The fact that people use hideous jargon is no reason to use hideous jargon in a court of appeals. Anyway, the question remains, if the bankruptcy judge's decision to reduce the value of the hospital on account of the imputed taxation of a potential imputed buyer, if that's wrong, does it change the outcome? Right? If you reduce those deductions, does that make the hospital solvent on the critical date?
I don't think so, Your Honor. That's not addressed on
right,
this
that's
appeal.
That's the thing on which I thought you were disagreeing with him. And when you answer, I don't think so, why are you giving that answer?
Because
your reasoning?
We did not address that particular issue, and I did not do the math.
That's fine, but I'm asking you now, what's your reasoning for giving me the answer that it doesn't change the outcome?
My having looked at that issue in the past and recalling that it did not change the outcome.
So, in other words, you can't give me a reason.
That's correct.
Okay.
Did you think they waived those arguments?
Not the tax affecting, but they definitely waived the contingent liability and the discounting of the contingent liabilities issues. Those were never raised in the bankruptcy court, and the contingent liability issue was not raised until this appeal. Their expert had a laundry list of criticisms of our expert's report. It was done in response to our expert's report. And discounting of the contingent liabilities was not among them. This is the first time on this appeal where they're raising that issue. In fact, the whole hindsight issue is new, or was new in the district court. So those issues should have been addressed in the bankruptcy court. And one of the reasons that we're handicapped in responding to those issues is because nobody ever challenged the numbers. Nobody ever challenged the methodology. Both experts used essentially the same numbers, used those 1998 settlements in determining what the adjustment to revenue would be. One thing I'd like to mention is what I view as the key to reaching the conclusion that the money that belonged to Doctors Hospital, that the money going to the cash collateral account belonged to Doctors Hospital, is to recognize that MMA funding, after the funds came out of the Daiwa account, was upstreaming dividends to its parent, Doctors Hospital.
What does upstreaming mean? This is more jargon. What does it actually mean?
It's making a distribution.
Just distributing dividends.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And so when the funds go into the cash collateral account, they belong to Doctors Hospital, as they had to, so that Doctors Hospital could take care of its obligation to LaSalle. And another point on that argument is that there's no doubt that MMA funding gave up its right to the funds at some point. MMA funding was never supposed to get this money, and it didn't have an operating business. Doctors Hospital did, and so Doctors Hospital needed the money to operate. So the logical point for the money to become Doctors Hospital by way of a distribution is before the money went to the cash collateral account, because there was an obligation to be paid to LaSalle, and then the remainder of the funds would come through the account, the cash collateral account, and go back to Doctors Hospital. One way of confirming this is that if you look at the transaction structure before July 1998, you had funds coming from Daiwa and then going to the MMA funding account and then automatically going to Doctors Hospital. And there were distributions to Doctors Hospital. And then what Doctors Hospital did was pay directly to the cash collateral account, so there was no issue whether the funds belonged to MMA funding. After July 1998, all that happened is this new Nomura loan transaction was superimposed on the old Daiwa loan transaction. But the structure of the Daiwa loan didn't change. All that changed was the funds went from the MMA funding account to the cash collateral account directly rather than going through the MMA funding account and Doctors Hospital. But there were still dividends that MMA funding was giving to Doctors Hospital. The, The bankruptcy court didn't discuss this issue in its original opinion, but on a motion to amend, when LaSalle moved to amend the judgment on a couple of points, the bankruptcy court did directly address this issue of how the cash flowed after July 1998 and said pretty emphatically that the money going to the hospital was the money going to the cash collateral account was rent. And that's the only time that the bankruptcy court really faced up to what was happening with this cash flow. And when it did that, it made a clear determination that the money did belong to Doctors Hospital as it flowed into the cash collateral account. LaSalle and the district court, they say that when the district court or when the bankruptcy court made those statements, that it was only talking about the pre-July 1998 transfers. And that's not correct. It can't be, because the bankruptcy court was specifically talking about the cash flow structure that was imposed upon the parties, imposed by LaSalle after July 1998. That's the first time that that cash flow was in place. So even the bankruptcy court finally saw that the transaction documents themselves show that the money going to the cash collateral account after 1998 belonged to Doctors Hospital and were therefore fraudulent transfers to LaSalle, just like the pre-July 1998 transfers were. And so the court should make a de novo review on this issue and reverse the district court and the bankruptcy court. We've made three other arguments, and I'll touch on one. We argued that the bankruptcy court should look beyond the form of this transaction and look to its substance and recognize that Doctors Hospital was the borrower on the Daiwa loan. This is different than our other theories of alter ego and contract modification. Under the case law, a court of equity, a bankruptcy court, will look beyond the transaction documents to the transaction substance to avoid fraudulent transfers. And the courts look to the knowledge and intent of the parties. And here the intent, clear from the way the transaction was set up, was to get the money to Doctors Hospital so it could run its business. In addition, there was no real sale of Doctors Hospital's receivables to MMA Funding.
Did you make that argument in the bankruptcy court?
Yes, sir.
Have you made it here? Because I tried to find that in your brief and didn't see it.
Oh, yes. It's a we have four separate arguments, and it's one argument.
Okay. Where should I look in your brief for this argument? Don't answer from over there. Come back to the podium where you will be recorded for posterity.
Sorry, Your Honor. I apologize.
For the benefit of all the podcasters who download all oral arguments of the Seventh Circuit over the Internet.
The argument begins on page 29, Your Honor. But the bankruptcy court, when we made this argument, refused to look at the substance of the transaction. The bankruptcy court said that this was a...
The heading, you're thinking of the thing beginning with the heading, MMA failing, funding's failure to function as the parties intended?
Well, there's a heading...
That's not the issue that I was raising.
There's a heading C, the substance of the Daiwa loan was a loan to the hospital. That's the main heading for this argument.
Tell me again what page this is at in your brief. Are we looking at... Maybe I'm just not looking at the right document. Plaintiff appellee, cross appellants, combined responsive brief in main appeal and opening brief in cross appeal.
Right. Page 29, Your Honor.
All right. Well, I will look at it again, but okay.
In any event, the bankruptcy court did not look at the substance at all. It cut off all examination of this issue because of the status of MMA funding as a special purpose entity, and just never faced up to what this doctrine requires. And so this court could reverse on that ground as well. I see my time is up, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fry. You have anything further, Mr. Audley? You probably have 30 seconds, but I'll give you an extra 2 minutes, and if we're still asking questions, you can always answer them.
Thank you, Your Honor, and we'll try to do so. As to the true sale argument, Your Honor, we will point to the record before the bankruptcy court where Mr. Costello, who was the lead trial attorney, opened up the proceeding by announcing that he's not seeking to suggest that this wasn't a true sale in the normal sense of the arguments that could have been made that Your Honor has now presented. So there was never even an attempt to put on evidence in that regard, let alone have findings in that regard. So we again respectfully submit that the bankruptcy trustee has waived that argument. Secondly, Judge Rovner had identified certain confusion from the charts, et cetera, and this is obviously with the cash flows and the various parties, obviously something that needs to be analyzed with some detail. I do want to point out, however, that during the life of the Daiwa loan, MMA Funding was the entity that provided what are called the borrowing base certificates, and in banking jargon at least, that those are the key documents to verify at every time that you're asking for a loan for a receivable as collateral, that you're identifying that you own that receivable, that you're representing that it's your own. Now, as to at least the function of MMA funding, therefore that borrowing base certificates, unless you're committing bank fraud, certainly was a function that MMA funding performed and performed consistently, and it was one of the aspects that Judge Schmederer relied upon in determining that indeed MMA funding did function as the borrower under the Daiwa loan. As to the monies going into the cash collateral account, again, the documents negotiated by fairly sophisticated entities, including the payment direction letter, the intercreditor agreement, the cash collateral account agreement, and the collection account agreement, all were set up so that it was idealized that MMA funding would still be the borrower. But instead of the monies going down to Doctors Hospital, they call it either an upstream dividend or a payment to Doctors Hospital, it would flow directly to the cash collateral account, which itself had a specific, specified, and required waterfall, such that buckets then had to be filled. By that I mean accounts had to be filled for the debt service.
If you could get rid of the jargon.
Yes, Your Honor.
When I think waterfall, I think Niagara Falls.
Understood, Your Honor. What I mean was there was a direction as to how the funds needed to be applied in certain orders of priority. My apologies. And in that regard, the priorities were established by an unambiguous document that Judge Schmederer took great pains to review and determined that this wasn't an upstream dividend to Doctors Hospital. Doctors Hospital did obviously get monies, over $67 million, over the course of this facility after everyone else was paid, because they did need operations. That was the whole idea. No one was suggesting they didn't.
Thank you very much, Mr. Audley. Thank you, Mr. Fry. The case is taken under advisement.